For the week of December 4th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 128, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In a very windy Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
In New York City, I'm Michael Giltz.
And joining us today, we have Alonzo Duralde, of course, an entertainment journalist. Now, Alonzo, right before the show, we were going over all of the many outlets you write for. So I know you're writing a column for the iPad version of Box Office Magazine.
Right. I do a column for them called Final Grade, where I grade a movie's opening weekend at the box office and look at how the marketing and other factors helped or hurt it. My main gig right now is I'm the film critic for TheWrap.com. And I am also the co-host of the Linoleum Knife podcast and one of the critics featured on What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
And most importantly, the author of
Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, which makes a dandy stocking stuffer at this time of year.
Yes, which is precisely why I remembered this year. I actually had it for 12 months. I had in my calendar, call Alonzo before Christmas, not after, to have him on the show to talk about the book.
And that is why you are an eminence grise of the podcast world, Jay Sperling.
I'm going to look that word up, actually. But Alonzo will be joining us for the entire show. We'll talk about his book during the movie section. But on today's show, we'll not only be talking to Alonzo about Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, we'll also
movie,
be going
movie.
Oh my gosh, you know what? In the show notes, I wrote Merry Little Christmas. You're right. It is movie.
For 12 months, Sperling, you've had to learn this.
I know. I didn't do well on the SATs either, if that makes any difference. We'll also be going over all of the accolades being handed out by the likes of the National Board of Review, the New York Film Critics Association, and the Spirit Awards. Speaking of accolades, Michael, the Grammy Award nominations were announced last week, and we'll go over a few of them. There's no way we can go over all of them since there are like 952. We'll argue about NBC's Up All Night again, and then we've got some theater news for you. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, and end with some correspondence from listeners. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Yes, we have the totals for the worldwide box office this weekend. In the U.S., it was a very slow weekend, one of the slower weekends of the year because everybody has gorged themselves on movies over the Thanksgiving holiday. But worldwide, the number one movie around the world is Twilight Saga: Breaking Dawn Part 1, which grossed $57 million around the world. It's at $588 million and counting, and it looks to gross just about exactly the same as the last two movies in the Twilight series. Number two around the world is Puss in Boots, which grossed another $26 million. It's at $228 million worldwide and counting. Number three, another animated film, Happy Feet 2, $22 million worldwide. It's at $86 million and counting. There's no way to paint this as anything other than a disappointment. At number four, the jury is still out on Arthur Christmas, which grossed another $18 million worldwide. It's at $43 million and counting. It's doing very well in the UK. Everyone in the US expects us to see this movie have legs, and we're going to hear more about Alonzo on this movie and the marketing of it in just a few moments. At number five is The Muppets, which grossed another $13 million worldwide. It's just starting to open up overseas. It's at $60 million in counting. At number six, the French comedy Intouchables. This is the comedy about the quadriplegic wealthy old man and his ex-con caregiver, which grossed another $11.9 million. It's grossed $92 million in France alone. It's about to barrel past $100 million. This is an absolutely huge phenomenon in that country. It's going to be fascinating to see how it does around the rest of the world. Look for the remake any day now.
Now, just to put that in perspective, and not to interrupt you, Michael, just to put that in perspective, I was doing some research on the number of screens that are in France. There's about 5,550 screens in France, and it's made $92 million there, this film, Intouchables. There are 40,000 screens in the U.S. and Canada. So when a film makes $100 million here, it's on 3,000 screens.
So you're saying France is a smaller country than the U.S.?
Yes, but I do have a PhD in the obvious.
It's true. It's a very small country. $92 million is a huge amount. We'll have to get a list of the top grossing movies of all time in France. It's certainly going to probably be in that top 20 at the very least before all is said and done. At number seven around the world is The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. It's at $10 million worldwide and counting. It's grossed I'm sorry, that's for the weekend. It's grossed $221 million so far. It opens in the U.S. in late December. And number eight is the Justin Timberlake film In Time. It grossed another $10 million. It's at $118 million worldwide and counting. Number nine is Tower Heist, another $8 million. It's at $113 million worldwide. And number 10 is Hugo, the Martin Scorsese family film, which grossed $7.6 million, basically in the U.S. only. It's at $25 million and counting. And of course, there were a lot of small art films that have been platforming out in the U.S. A couple of them did very well. Shame and The Artist, one of my favorite films of the year, are doing very well in limited release, along with My Week with Marilyn and A Dangerous Method. And The Descendants is in the top 10 in the U.S. That's the George Clooney film. It grossed another $5.2 million over the weekend. It's at $18 million so far, and it's still in a relatively limited release with only a couple hundred screens going for it. But the question is Arthur Christmas. This is a movie that would be featured in a future edition of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. It's gotten great reviews. It's from the people behind Wallace and Gromit. It hasn't quite caught fire in the U.S., but people think it might. Alonzo, what do you think they did with this movie?
Oh, God, everything wrong, basically, because this is a movie that I'm literally begging people to go see, and they're constantly telling me they hate the posters, they hate the trailer. The ads don't say that it's from Aardman, and you know, to try and sell the connection to, you know, Wallace and Gromit and Chicken Run. It looks they make the ads look too much like those prep and landing specials. The title doesn't even really work in the United States, because in England, you know, they say Father Christmas as much as they say Santa Claus. So Arthur Christmas, or Arthur, as they would say it there, is a play on words. Here, people think that it's connected to the PBS Aardvark or yep. Russell brand. Everything that they could have possibly done to turn people off of this movie, they have done. And it kills me, because I really love this film. And absolutely, if I ever get to do another edition of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, this will be in there. I think it's a great family film. Kids will love it. Adults will find it appealing and funny. But my God, just getting people into the theater for critics, I just know from one-on-one conversations, people don't believe that it's good because they've been so turned off by the marketing.
And I have to say, I agree with everything you've just said, Alonzo. I saw the film and I really liked it. In fact, I walked out thinking there must be something wrong with me. I liked this movie a lot, and I'm sure everybody who's in the know, everybody, you know, all the hipsters will hate it. And sure enough, that's not true. Everybody loves it. That actually goes to see it.
Exactly, but it's the getting their butts into the seats is the challenge here, because people have been actively turned off by the way this film is being sold.
I thought it was based on the Arthur character from PBS. I had no idea it was from the Aardman people. And, you know, hey, it's my job to know. So that's how much they fooled me on this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And if we don't know these things, of course, the public's not going to be, you know, tuned into it. So, yeah, Sony gets very bad marks for me on how they've sold this film.
Sony has always kind of done a bad job when it's come to animation. I mean, have they had a good animated film? Not necessarily critically, but financially. Do they know how to sell animation?
Well, I think Surf's Up did okay. I mean, and it got an Oscar nomination.
Okay at best, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
But it's just not their world. They don't do that many animated films, do they?
Not so much, no. I mean, they had, what, they have the one with the, what is it, the bear and the elk with the one antler or whatever.
Oh, I just saw that one. Hunting Season, Open Season. Open Season.
Yeah, that's them. These are not waters they get into very often. But I mean, there's no excuse for a studio not to know how to sell a G or PG rated movie, because so much of the market now is dominated by kids movies. And that's so much of that's one of the last reliable audiences. I mean, if we've learned anything for the last 6 months, it's that, you know, movies that were targeted at young males, you know, like males 14 to 21 or whatever, that area, those guys are playing video games and downloading movies off the internet. They are not a reliable audience anymore. Then they used to be the target of Hollywood. But now one of the most reliable people to show up for films are, you know, kids and their parents for kids movies. And so there's no excuse for a studio not to know how to market, how to reach that audience, and you know, how to make these films lucrative, because certainly something as good as Arthur Christmas, with the pedigree that it has, should have been a much bigger hit.
Well, speaking as a parent, I can tell you that maybe part of the problem with family movies is 3D ticket price fatigue, because when you go to the movies with two children and, you know, two adults, and you're asked to pay $60 for tickets, it becomes a little tiring, you know, every other week.
You have to see Arthur in 3D?
Oh, not at all. No. I don't think, I mean, it's fine. It's not bad 3D, but I don't think it enhances the experience so much that you couldn't just skip it and see it flat.
See Tintin in 3D, Arthur Christmas, it doesn't matter.
Right, yeah, yeah. Hugo definitely, well, Tintin, that's a whole other story, but.
Yeah.
If you go to alonzoduraldi.com, you can see a video montage that they've created inspired by his book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. It's really good. It's about a 7-minute long montage of scenes from classic Christmas movies, both the obvious ones and unexpected, like Die Hard and things like that. It's a lot of fun and a great example of fair use, I might add. I wonder if Alonzo's gotten any blowback from all the clips that he uses. But
luckily, no. I've had some people that don't want to post it on their site because they're afraid that they're going to get into trouble. But you know, I really, all the clips are really short, so I do think it falls into the fair use umbrella. And also, absolutely. I think it's inspiring people to want to go see these movies. So
exactly. So tell us about the book that it sort of comes from.
Sure. Well, it's as I'm sure has happened to you over the years, Michael, you know, the holidays roll around and editors want listicles of, you know, alternative Christmas movies or, you know, Christmas movies that you don't realize are Christmas movies or whatever. And I had written enough of those over the years, and I'm sort of a Christmas fan myself, that I thought that, it would be fun to do a film guide that was all about Christmas movies and that it would span the gamut from the obvious sort of Miracle on 34th Streets and Christmas Stories, but also include, you know, Die Hard and Eyes Wide Shut and Less Than Zero and The Lion in Winter and movies that are set at Christmas time that we may or may not necessarily think of as Christmas films. And so over the course of the book, there's an entire chapter on all the many, many adaptations of Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol. But there's
I'm
also,
sure it's not complete.
Oh, thank you. But there's a chapter about horror movies. There's a chapter about action crime films and you know, all sorts of stuff. So it's a genre that really encompasses almost every other genre. And it was fun to kind of to take Christmas movies into all the various avenues that they've followed over the years.
It's available at Amazon and fine bookstores everywhere. It's a $17 list. You can probably find it on sale some places. So it's a lot of fun. But of course, the list of adaptations of A Christmas Carol, those are strictly film versions, right? Do they go into the TV versions?
Well, a few of them. I mean,
Mr. Magoo.
There was that period of, you know, Scrooge is a ruthlessly ambitious career woman movies. So I included all of those, like A Carol Christmas with Tori Spelling and Ms. Scrooge with Cicely Tyson and Ebby with Susan Lucci and A Diva's Christmas Carol with Vanessa Williams. And Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol was actually originally produced for television as well.
Right.
You know, I'm actually glad that you mentioned the Tori Spelling a Christmas movie, because in the description of the book, it says you mentioned Tori Spelling, and I was wondering what Christmas movie was she in? Better yet, what movie was she in, let alone what Christmas movie? But I'm glad you mentioned it.
It was made for TV. It's called A Carol Christmas, and she's actually a better Scrooge than you might imagine.
And how did you feel about Harold and Kumar's 3D Christmas?
I had a blast with that movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. In fact, I want to try and see it again before the holidays are over, just because that's, again, a rare movie where it's worth seeing it in 3D because they aggressively milk 3D as the gimmick that it is. And so they make no pretensions about doing anything artful with it. It's just like it's in your face and it's let's throw things at the camera and be silly with it. And you know, I think for the most part, if you're going to be 3D, you might as well be shameless about it and, you know, bring back the paddleball guy from, you know, the original House of Wax and just, you know, be shameless.
On the downside, you do have to see movies like Thomas Kincaid's Christmas Cottage.
Which, with the right crowd and enough wine, is a lot of fun, I have to say.
And I think the key ingredient there would not necessarily be the crowd, but the wine.
Well, you kind of have to have both. I think watching it alone with a lot of wine would just be sad at the holidays, frankly.
I believe that renders you an alcoholic.
That's when you know you've hit bottom.
Yes.
I think the next step for Arthur Christmas will hopefully be if it gets nominated for Best Animated Film, which I think is a possibility given the love they have for the Aardman Studio Productions. But we are obviously in, you know, award season. And so we have a lot of awards that have come out. There'll be a big flood of them. Most of them don't matter until we get to the Golden Globes and then the Oscars. But to run up, which just happened in the last week, the New York Film Critics Circle came out with their picks. They named the best film of the year as The Artist. The National Board of Review picked Martin Scorsese's Hugo. In Europe, Lars von Trier's film Melancholia won the best film at European Film Awards. And that was also number 2 in the New York Film Critics balloting.
And what was his acceptance speech when he won and got up there? Did he say anything interesting?
I don't know if he was even there.
No, he wasn't. The joke was he wasn't there because he's no longer speaking in public. So his producer got up and said, well, you know, Lars would have been here and he would have given me a statement, but he no longer makes public statements.
That's very sad. And the Spirit Award nominees were announced. I'm not quite sure why the artist was eligible, but it was, along with American indie films like Take Shelter and Drive and Beginners and 50-50 and The Descendants.
Well, so, I've been on the Spirit Awards jury before, and I can tell you that their rules for what constitutes an American film basically boils down to the director there's like the director, producer, writer, and I think like if more than one of them are Americans, then that counts as an American film. And so I think in the case of the artist, I believe the director is an American
French
resident or something. I forget how that played out. But yeah, it actually did, by their rules, qualify as an American film.
So looking early on, what do you think the fallout is from this first batch of nominations?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think obviously the artist, you know, it could use the boost, and it being a Weinstein title, I'm sure they're looking at it as their sort of king's speech this year in terms of being a nicely middle brow, you know, film that will appeal to older Academy voters, but also to, you know, other audiences and to critics, obviously. So that gives it a help. You know, and
that was the New York Film Critics Circle that gave it the best picture, along with the film's director, Michael Hazanavicius. I hope I just pronounced that right. But then, you know, they also, Meryl Streep won Best Actress for Margaret Thatcher in The Iron Lady, Brad Pitt for Best Actor. Then you go to the National Board of Review. It's a completely different group of people.
Yeah, the National Board of Review, let's face it, is a joke. Those guys aren't even critics. It's like literally people who want to pay money to belong to an organization where they get to see movies early. I don't really know who they are, but I know they aren't film critics, despite what the titles of their organization sort of suggest. So they're you know, an amusing stop along the way for this sort of thing, but I don't think they really hold much weight in the grand scheme of things.
And as far as I'm concerned, their picking Hugo makes it really a joke.
Well, the DC critics voted this morning, and they gave best film to The Artist, but best director to Scorsese for Hugo.
And the New York film critics gave Hugo was third on their balloting. I mean, I'm just stunned that people could even remotely think of this as one of the best films of the year.
I'm not a big fan of it, but I see why people are responding to it. But I, you know, I have my own issues with it, and I think that you know, as Scorsese is one of those people who, generally speaking, unless he's making something really odd off base, like, you know, Kundun, or that's not one of his usual kind of things, you know, he's generally going to be considered a player going into Oscar season.
Well, now with the Spirit Awards, I mean, there really is no front runner this year for Best Picture Oscar. There do seem to be in the actor categories, in the director categories, as you said, some kind of clear front runners. You have Meryl Streep. You have Brad Pitt and George Clooney, George Clooney being in The Descendants. Jessica Chastain, it seems like it is her year for...
Not really, because she is in so many films that come Oscar time, she's probably going to defeat herself, and, you know, she may end up getting two nominations or none, you know.
Yeah, it'll be curious to see if they decide, like, which one they think she's got the better shot for. I would imagine that probably Tree of Life, just because... The Help, I'm sure they're going to be, for, in the supporting category, be leaning on Octavia Spencer, who the DC critics awarded this morning.
Well, now, what about Tilda Swinton for We Need to Talk About Kevin? Michael, you and I saw this film in Cannes. You didn't like it as much as I did necessarily, but you had read the book. It was a strong performance, though.
Yeah, but if she's won award before, she's certainly in the running. You know, there aren't always that very many great female performances, so she's certainly in the mix.
I'm assuming that somebody on Team Glenn Close probably got a tongue lashing, if not a firing, after the Spirit Award nominations came out, because I know she's really gunning to finally win an Oscar this year for Albert Nobbs, and she was not nominated for a Spirit Award nomination, but her co-star Janet McTeer was.
Yikes.
Yeah, well, that, and, you know, just from the role alone, you'd think she'd be nominated, but, you know, the thing is, nobody saw that film.
Well, not yet. It hasn't opened yet. I mean, it's still in its, you know, it hasn't even had its consideration run yet. So
yeah, the people on the boards have seen it, though.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Well, you know, but George Clooney wasn't nominated for in the Spirit Awards either.
Well, he'll get other awards, so he doesn't really need them anymore.
That's true.
It is up for Best Feature, though, The Descendants.
Yes. But now, speaking of awards, we should probably move on into music, where the Grammy nominations were announced, I don't even know when. I guess it was Tuesday or Wednesday of last week. I didn't have power for half the week, so I don't know what's going on. Still, the Grammy Awards were nominated. What were they nominated for, Michael? Michael,
Best Emmy. They were nominated for, the Grammy nominations were announced. The ceremony will be held February 12th. Even the nominations felt like a coronation for Adele. She got all the big awards in all the big categories. Album of the Year for 21, Record of the Year for Rolling in the Deep, Song of the Year for Rolling in the Deep. She's just all over the place.
Kanye West would probably take offense at that because, of course, he received the most nominations.
Well, yeah, but he actually got blocked out of all the big categories. Kanye West had a bad night. This guy's been wanting to win Grammy for Album of the Year for years now, obviously, as we all know. But in fact, he wasn't even nominated. He had two albums out. He had a critically acclaimed album, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, and his collaboration with Jay-Z, Watch the Throne. They're both up for Best Rap Album, but neither of them got nominated for Album of the Year. Frankly, I think it's his best album, and I think he should have been nominated. I would have taken out, Foo Fighters or Rihanna. But, you know, the list
Do you think he Jessica Chastained himself? And
Well, that, you know, in a way, absolutely. You know, because those are, I'm sure that the rap contingent didn't know which album to get behind. And so that probably split his vote a bit for Album of the Year. That's absolutely a problem. It's a nice one to have, I suppose. But the result is that the five albums of the year are Adele for 21, Foo Fighters for Wasting Light, Lady Gaga for Born This Way, Bruno Mars for the very good album Doo-Wops and Hooligans, and Rihanna for Loud. And everybody expects Adele to win Album of the Year.
What about Record of the Year, Rolling in the Deep?
She's going to be the queen of the night. The question is, will she be able to perform? She's just had vocal surgery. She may not be ready by February 12th to sing at the Grammys, but she'll be there and maybe croak out a thank you. But they're going to have to make some excitement out of the fact that it's, you know, queen for a day or something like that, because everyone, I don't even know if bookies are taking money on this one. She will almost unquestionably win Album of the Year.
And Mumford & Sons was nominated for Record of the Year 1 year after they sang the very song they're nominated for on the awards.
Well, the Grammys have a weird thing where their calendar year ends like in September. And so all the fall releases are not available, are not eligible till the following year and a half later. So it's they always seem a little bit out of sync to me. It always bothers me. They feel like they can't do it because of the need to actually hear all the music that's come out and then have the nominations announced early and have the awards early in 2012. They just don't think they can go to a calendar year category. I think they should, because I don't think it works for them. But so you end up getting, you know, a song nominated 1 year and the album the next year, or the album this year and a song a year and a half or 2 years later. It just makes them feel out of step a little bit. And that's one good example of that.
Well, you know the best example of it, in my opinion? And Alonzo, you can tell me. I mean, do you know who Bon Iver is, Alonzo?
You know, I am so out of it musically. It's not even funny.
Okay.
I've seen the name, but I don't really know anything about Bon Iver, she or they.
Bon Iver is
that's how little I know.
Bon Iver is a band, but it's Justin Vernon's kind of group. He's the lead singer and the songwriter, and he kind of picks the musicians and tours with them. I've seen them live; they're really good. And you know what? He's had two albums and an EP out, and so now how is he nominated for Best New Artist?
Oh, well, this happens every year. This is basically best artists that the Grammys just noticed were happening. I mean, I always remember the year that when Stacey's Mom came out and they nominated Fountains of Wayne for Best New Artist, and they had been making albums for at least like 5 years or something.
Oh, I think that was like their sixth or seventh album at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, but you know, it's a very tricky category. Do you, especially today when anybody can release an album on their own, I mean, do you eliminate someone from Best New Artist because they've been independently releasing albums for 4 or 5 years, got picked up by a major label, and finally have an album out? I mean, that would be bizarre. Similarly, you've got Nicki Minaj, who has been around for several years with mixtapes and appearing on other people's albums. By the time her debut album came out, it felt like she was a superstar, and it did get good reviews, and she's nominated for Best New Artist. But why would you punish her for being around and hot and, you know, building up her career before her debut album came out? I mean, there's no good way to do it other than sort of a person-by-person basis, but you can't make up rules like that. So they come up with rules to say, okay, Bon Iver, you know, I think his album For Emma came out in 2007 independently, but it didn't really get attention until, you know, 2009, 2010, well, which is the year that he's eligible.
It's the one category that isn't contingent on the calendar year that the Grammys have set up. So they can basically do whatever they want.
Well, and they also want to make sure that they don't, they bizarrely disqualify some people because they had a single released 3 years earlier on a major label, though nobody paid attention to it and they had no album. You know, it gets they're trying their best. And it's not a bad list. The band Perry is a country band. They've had albums out, I think they formed in 2005. Bon Iver clearly came within everybody's attention within the last 2 years. J. Cole and Nicki Minaj, both of whom had mixtapes and stuff like that before their solo debuts. And Skrillex, who I've never heard of.
Skrillex is kind of a running joke, I think, based on his haircut. But he is an electronica artist.
Well, there you go. If you want to talk about jokes, Seth MacFarlane of Family Guy got nominated for Best Traditional Pop Vocal Album alongside Tony Bennett, Harry Connick Jr., and Barbara Streisand. He doesn't embarrass himself if you see him sing, but he's not actually a good singer.
No.
Much better is Steve Martin, who is nominated again for Best Bluegrass Album for his work with the Deep Canyon Rangers. You know, he's really plugging away at his bluegrass career. And another guaranteed winner for the night alongside Adele has got to be the Book of Mormon for Best Cast Album. It's up against revivals of Anything Goes and How to Succeed in Business, and I'll fall out of my chair if it doesn't win the Grammy Award.
I don't even know how to follow that up. You know, you're going to be falling out of your chair. Other than to say, maybe we should talk about, you know, whether you're surprised about any of the nominees for the Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Now, I don't think have they announced this year's nominees yet?
No, it's coming up soon. But there was an article in the New York Times talking, it sort of combined two different articles. One is a sort of claim that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, getting into it, boosts an artist's career and gives them a huge chance to cash in, which I found a little suspect as soon as I heard it.
Well,
and the other
there's a lot of broad claims made in this article, which I know you take offense at. And I guess when I said have the nominations come out, it was my way of kind of moving into this story, which I know you found very, you didn't like this story necessarily.
Right, it ran in the business section of the New York Times. Half of it was about people politicking to get into the hall, which is sort of interesting. And the other half is this claim that if you get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you suddenly get a chance to cash in with tours and album sales and all that sort of thing. So they make a lot of broad claims for it, and I wasn't happy with the article. I didn't think it was very good.
Well, I know that when Bruce Springsteen got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, his career really took off.
Exactly. Last year, you had Neil Diamond, Alice Cooper, Darlene Love were among the people who got inducted into the hall.
I had not heard of until they were in the Hall of Fame.
Right. The idea that somebody said, you know what? I think now I'll go see Neil Diamond in concert. Now that he's in the Hall of Fame, now I'm interested. Do they have any album sale boost from being in the hall? Well, sure. Why not? You get some news attention. People say you're in the hall, but it's got to be minimal at best because these are long, well-established artists. It's like the Grammy Awards. If you perform live on the show or win Album of the Year, you can get a boost, but you know, you don't see an album boost from people getting inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. That just doesn't make any sense. But there were a number of things with the article I took issue with. The first thing was that they made a big claim about percentage increases in sales. You'll read this a lot in news stories. They'll say, oh my God, this artist appeared on The Daily Show, and then their book sales went up 300%.
Yeah, well, their book wasn't out last week, so...
Well, or it sold 60 copies and now it sold 300 copies. You know, percentage increases don't really mean much of anything. And in the New York Times, they say, quote, for the inductees, the reward can be enormous. Weekly record sales for a performer or band leap 40 to 60% on average in the weeks after selection, said David Bakula, a senior vice president at Nielsen SoundScan. Okay, but, you know, what were their sales? You know, again, going from 2,000 to 3,000, okay, they've increased an extra 1,500 copies in the weeks following the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If that's $10 a pop, that's an extra $15,000. Is that really a big payday for Alice Cooper? You know, and of course, the brief bump is pretty short-lived. But to say their sales go up 40% in a time when, you know, you can sell 8,000 copies and be in the top 10 on the Billboard charts doesn't really mean very much.
I think what this boils down to is not necessarily an air of legitimacy, which most of these artists don't need, but certainly maybe kind of a whiff of renewed relevance. And like you said, there's some news coverage, probably maybe some radio play, you know, and it's maybe a thing they can try and build off of. But I can't imagine being able to really quantify what it means for anybody in particular, because there's no control group. You know, we don't know what kind of year they would have had they not gotten inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Well, that's true, but you can't quantify album sales. But saying increased by 40% doesn't mean much. But if you say, well, okay, here we go. We have some hard figures for Alice Cooper. It says that in 2011, his sales have increased from 75,000 to 115,000 so far. So that's an increase of an extra 40,000 albums. That's
pretty good, actually.
That's a 30% increase. Yeah, it is pretty good. But of course, then you look, well, what's happened this year? Well, he did get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He also released Welcome to My Nightmare, an album that is a sequel to his classic solo debut from the 70s. It was his first top 40 album in 22 years. It was his first album of any sort in 3 years. So if you look at this year, anytime you release a new album, you're going to have more album sales than the year before, especially if you didn't, you know, release an album that year. So it had been 3 years since he put out an album. Did the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame make this album do better? I doubt it. And, you know, come on. He hadn't released an album in three years, so last year he didn't have that.
Again, this is where you get into the area of things you can't quantify. Did the press that he got from the Hall of Fame thing make more people write about the album or give him more places to promote the album? Arguably.
What's your guess?
But we don't know if the new album without the Hall would have done just as well. So, you know, it gets sort of vague at this point.
Well, but if you don't release an album for 3 years and you release a new album and you tour and you promote
it. What I'm saying is that we don't know whether or not the album would have sold as well with or without the Hall's, you know, endorsement of him. And that's what I'm saying. It gets into an area where, since there's no control group, there's really no way to quantify. Maybe the new album would have done just as well without the Hall. Maybe it would have done, who knows, better without the Hall. Who knows? This is all sort of a guessing game.
Well, not when the album has only sold 115,000 copies, and not exactly a lot. I mean, when his total sales for the year are only 115,000, clearly that's not much of a boost. You know, he piggybacked on the biggest album of his career. He had all the attention possible, and he still only sold 100,000 copies of all his albums that year. He also had Rhino re-releasing his albums, putting out box sets, promoting it based on the award show. So clearly, with all that effort, the most they could do was sell 150,000 copies this year so far. You know, that's not exactly much of a boost to boast about.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that all this stuff exists in this sort of like rather unquantifiable, you know, netherworld. So I think for the New York Times to try and make a direct connection between this stuff is, you know, they're sort of grasping at straws.
Well, here's one point where they're absolutely wrong. They make a claim about Fleetwood Mac and they say sales of Fleetwood Mac albums jumped to 3.2 million in 1998 when that band was inducted from 483,000 in 1997, according to SoundScan. Well, I'm not quite sure what they were looking at, but in 1997, the year before they were inducted, they released The Dance, a live album, which is one of the biggest albums of their career. It sold 15 million copies worldwide, at least 3 or 4 million in that calendar year of 1997. It's one of the best-selling live albums of all time. All I can imagine is that the New York Times asked for information on sales of studio albums from 1997, because that's the only thing that I can figure out of how they would come up with this idea. Their live album came out in 97. It was a massive hit. There's no way they had more album sales in 1998 versus 1997. And if they did, it's because of The Dance, this wildly popular live album. So the article's just filled with a lot of confusing and misleading stuff that made me very unhappy.
Well, maybe we can move on to television news, and that might make you a bit happier. Now, I know, Alonzo, you watch a lot of television because I swear on Twitter, I constantly see that you've checked into some show. On Get Glue.
I'm a Get Glue addict. I admit it.
Have you adapted any new show from the fall season? Have you picked up any new drama or sitcom that you're now watching regularly?
Yeah, a couple. Up All Night and Suburgatory, for sure, are new shows that have stuck with me that I didn't bail on after about three episodes.
Now it's very interesting that you should mention Up All Night, because the whole reason that we are actually talking about this freshman scorecard. Is because last week we had a bit of a conversation that may have grown heated, I guess would be the best way to define it. We had this debate over Up All Night and whether it was a hit. Now, NBC is claiming it's a hit, and I believe the article that we cited was maybe from Vulture or from the New York Times. They were claiming, look, it's a modest hit. It's a hit for NBC. It's got, you know, 4.5 million viewers. Michael said, well, it's not even in the top 40. Heck, it's not even in the top 50.
Yeah, well, I said at best you could claim it was showing modest signs of life. NBC's moving it to Thursday, giving it a shot, replacing Community with Up All Night. Good for them. They have no real success stories to talk about. They felt like Up All Night has a pulse, and they're moving it to Thursday, and that's how it should be described. Calling it a hit is very much a stretch. And so we were looking at the freshman series scorecard of Mark Berman, our friend at TVMediaInsights.com. And every week he grades shows and looks at them and how they're doing based on the competition, the lead-in, the time slot, and how the time slot did the year before, quality of the show, buzz factor, and all that sort of stuff. He doesn't think Up All Night is doing very well. He gives it a D, which puts it towards the bottom of the pack. But there are fans like Alonzo who like the show. And this is a commercial ranking. This is not his personal, you know, critical opinion on the show. This is him saying, how well is this show doing given all these other factors? Right now, he gives it a D. It's Wednesday at 8 p.m. It's anchoring the night. And now NBC is moving it to Thursday so that more people can follow Alonzo and find out that the show is worth watching. Make the case for it, Alonzo.
You know, I just think it's a witty show, and it's got three very strong comic leads. You've got Christina Applegate and Will Arnett and Maya Rudolph. It's a clever show, but it's not, you know, sitcom-y clever necessarily. I mean, it really is so much of it is really character based, and for a show that's about new parents, they don't sort of fall back on a lot of sweatpant cliches or, reaction shots of adorable baby or any of the kind of things you might fear from this sort of show. It has one foot in the media world because the Christina Applegate character is a producer for an Oprah-like talk show that is hosted by the character played by Maya Rudolph, but it's not purely jokes about pop culture, although, they weave those in as well. I just think it does a lot of different things and it does them all well, and it's a consistently funny show. And, the characters are evolving as the show goes on, and I'm interested to see where it all goes.
Yeah, and I can tell you as a parent that a lot of the jokes and a lot of the situations that they find themselves in are very realistic.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
not being a dad, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm clueless, but that's nice to have that endorsement from somebody who knows what they're talking about.
And I can tell you, having just moved to the suburbs, suburgatory is very, very true as well. Some of the things, and they do play to the camp and to the, it's a show about a teenage girl who is moved from Brooklyn into the suburbs because her father is afraid that she's kind of going down the wrong path in the city. And she's kind of the hipster in the suburbs. And it's, to me, it's a very funny show.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really strong ensemble there. I mean, in addition to the two, the leads, you've also got like Cheryl Hines and Alan Tudyk and the actress from SNL, whose name is escaping me now.
Anna Gasteyer.
I just think it's a really sharp show, and it plays towards exaggerations, but I think at the same time really is grounded in a certain sense of reality, and it's got great banter.
And I would not have thought of Jeremy Sisto as a comic actor, but he does a good job on it, along with Jane Levy, who plays his daughter Tessa.
Yeah, absolutely. And that definitely Jeremy Sisto has been a big surprise on this, as far as being a really charming and funny guy. I like the actress who plays the daughter a lot. All the kids on the show are funny. The adults are funny. And it's just exaggerated, lampoony enough without being ridiculously grotesque. But I think rides a really good sort of comic balance as far as playing up the absurdity, but still being grounded in reality.
Well, if you're looking for things that aren't grounded in reality, or maybe they are, I mean, but they really are a huge satire and kind of go over the top, Book of Mormon on Broadway would probably fit that bill. And it turns out that they are earning their money back, right, Michael?
That's right. Broadway gets very excited when shows don't lose money. So 9 months after it opened, big news is that the Book of Mormon has earned back its $9 million budget. Everybody's very thrilled with that because most Broadway shows don't make money. You know, it's a big week for the Book of Mormon. They earned back their budget. They got nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Cast Album. And it's also revealed that they are sitting on a very big advance. Now, an advance is the amount of tickets they've sold for future performances. It's not tickets sold this week, which in the week that we're talking about, which is the Thanksgiving week, is about $1.6 million that they sold for the Thanksgiving week holiday, thanks to big ticket prices. But their advance refers to all the tickets that have been sold for November, December. I'm sorry, we're already in December. Late December, January, February, March, April, May. They're probably selling tickets 6 months to 8 months to almost a year in advance. And people are buying those tickets up. Right now, they're sitting on a $39 million pile of advance ticket sales.
And their budget was $9 million.
That's right. And that's about as big as it gets for a show. Two other shows that peaked in their peak earning power were The Lion King and Wicked. They at one point sat on ticket advances of about $40 million. I have no idea what they are sitting on right now. You really, can't get that information easily. Unless they release that info to us, we don't know what their advanced ticket sales are at. We can interview people at group sales companies and things like that and get an idea for how a show is doing. But unless they release that info, we don't really find that out. But $40 million is a huge advance. That's really some of the biggest shows of all time when you're talking about The Lion King and Wicked. So Book of Mormon in a much smaller house is sitting on $39 million in advanced ticket sales. This show is going to be there for years and years and years to come.
And it's a show I think that can tour really profitably. You know, you don't have any falling chandeliers or anything. And so you can probably take it on the road for a pretty reasonable amount of money. And you've got South Park fans everywhere who will want to see it.
True, though it is a bit of a risk for people that have subscribers and package these shows and bring people in for three or four shows in a season. The Book of Mormon is a bit of a risk because it's a very vulgar show.
And by vulgar, you mean they're cursing nonstop.
They're cursing nonstop and saying very crass things and things about having sex with babies to cure AIDS and ridiculous things like that. It's actually a very sweet-natured show. It pulls its punches and does not mock the idea of religion in general.
No, a lot of Mormons have actually endorsed the show, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, the official Mormon people are not happy with it. But yeah, there are individuals who've seen the show and recognize that there's an opportunity to tell their story and that it's not viciously anti-Mormon. It's sort of anti-religion in general, but in a sweet, nice way.
It's not a show that's going to have a big life as a high school musical, I would imagine.
Exactly.
But neither is Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. I can't even remember the name of the show. That's how, you know, yesterday's
Spider-Man,
news.
Turn Off the Dark.
Turn Off the Dark.
That's right.
But it seems to be making money. And over Thanksgiving week, everybody seemed to be making money.
Well, we're in the height biggest period of the year for Broadway. From Thanksgiving through Christmas, people just go to the theater nonstop, through New Year's, I should say. And, of course, they bump up their ticket prices as well. If you want to buy a ticket to see a show on New Year's Eve or right around Thanksgiving or Christmas, you're going to pay top, top dollar. This was apparently news to the New York Times and a couple other sites. They started writing about how the Book of Mormon and other shows are charging more for Friday and Saturday nights and for, you know, holidays. And that's practice been going on for literally decades.
Now, is that because of New Yorkers or because of tourists? Why the higher ticket prices?
Well, because they can charge them. So, you know, if you want to see a show on Friday or Saturday night.
Is it locals or is it tourists?
After a show has been open for 3 to 6 months, it's almost all tourists. That's New Yorkers go in the first 6 months, and then after that, if a show is still running, it's because people are coming from out of town to see it. Basically, they assume anyone in New York who wanted to see the show already has. So the hardcore theater goers go early on, and then after 3 to 6 months, it's tourists nonstop. So you're talking about people and companies who can write it off on their business accounts, people who are coming to New York for once a year, and they want to see a show on Friday night, and they're willing to pay, instead of $120, they're willing to pay $250 or $300 to see the Book of Mormon or Wicked or The Lion King, shows like that. So they always bump up tickets during the holidays. Big shows for a while now have been bumping up tickets for premium nights like Friday and Saturday. And you're seeing a little more sophistication, though, this dynamic pricing we're talking about, where prices will go up and down and lower the closer you get to opening night or go up higher. So, you know, they're not just sticking a price on it and then sitting there. They're getting like the airlines and really getting very fluid what prices you'll pay depending on the show, the day of the week, the time of the year, and all this sort of stuff.
Well, that's very, very good because, you know, the airline prices are so easy to figure out that now it'll make it much easier for consumers to know what they're going to pay for a Broadway show.
Well, it's pretty clear. If you want to see a really big hit show and you want to go on a big Friday or Saturday night, you're going to pay a lot of money. So that means why Thanksgiving week, we saw three shows gross over $2 million, which are The Wicked, The Lion King, and Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. We saw 10 shows grossing more than $1 million, which is a lot of money for a Broadway show. It's just a big time of year. Though we did mention, I think last week or the week before, that Mamma Mia was looking a little thin. And in fact, right after we said that, Mamma Mia announced for the very first time in history, it's been on Broadway for about a decade, they're going to be offering discount tickets in the winter season. That's January through March. That's the slowest time of the year to see a Broadway show. If you want to see a Broadway hit, come in January, February, and March when it's really cold and miserable in New York, and you'll have a lot better chance at getting a good ticket. Especially for Mamma Mia, they've discounted their prices in January through March for the first time ever.
Well, now, what do you think about Jim Parsons, who is on The Big Bang Theory? He's going to be headed to Broadway again. Of course, he debuted in The Normal Heart last year and got very favorable reviews. Now he's going to be playing the Jimmy Stewart role in Harvey.
Well, Alonzo, I imagine you've probably seen the film, haven't you?
Harvey, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, Jimmy Stewart's charming in it, but it's pretty dated, odd movie. I have never seen it as a play, but I imagine it's very dated, and it just doesn't seem like a very good property to me. He seems like a good fit for the role, but I'm not very excited about the play.
I'd say the show itself is thin gruel, but it is a really nice show place for, you know, showcase for the right kind of actor. And as to whether or not Parsons is, it's hard for me to say. I'm not a big fan of Big Bang Theory, and I find him distressingly thin. Every time I see him, like on an award show, I just think,
he needs to
God,
eat more.
Eat a cheeseburger.
God knows I do.
Well, now, what do you think of Kelly O'Hara? She's one of my favorite Broadway actresses. I've seen her in, what did I see her in? South Pacific and The Pajama Game. And she is just fantastic. I'm surprised she hasn't crossed over into television and movies. She's going to be doing a workshop of all things, The Bridges of Madison County, which, of course, was a very popular book, and then a movie directed by Clint Eastwood, starring both Eastwood and Meryl Streep. Why are they going to turn this into a musical?
Well, the Clint Eastwood Meryl Streep movie, I thought, was a dramatic improvement over the book. I mean, the book is a piece of junk. I thought the movie was actually pretty good, and I thought Streep gave an interesting, good performance. I can see why they'd want to musicalize it. The composer is Jason Robert Brown, who did Parade. Marsha Norman, who did the book for The Secret Garden and Night Mother, is doing the book for this show. Bartlett Scherer is the director. He did Light in the Piazza with Kelly O'Hara.
And South Pacific.
She's a delightful actress. I think she's too young. That's my initial thought was, well, isn't she too young and pretty for that role? I mean,
it's the reason they would want to make it into a musical is because it's got a big fat role for an actress of a certain age, you know. But Kelly O'Hara sounds like I'm not that familiar with her, but it sounds like she hasn't quite hit that age yet.
No,
yeah,
not at all.
She's young and pretty. I will tell you, though, some unlikely shows can become good musicals. I just saw the musical Once, which is based on the film. And I can't imagine a worse idea than trying to turn the movie Once into a musical, because the entire charm of the movie are these two people who are in love in real life in this wispy little film, but their chemistry together and their performances of their original music somehow caught lightning in a bottle and made this movie into a sensation. I didn't love the movie, but I liked it and was really happy to see its success. And I thought, why would you try and cast that as a musical?
The film had music in it. So, I mean, it's not too far of a stretch.
But the entire charm of the movie was those specific two people, the people who wrote the songs and non-actors who fell in love in real life. And, you know, that sort of bizarre intimacy and chemistry that they had blossomed in the film. But it was solely down to them.
And we're talking about Glenn Hansard and Marketa Irglova.
That's right.
It is very small and intimate. I can't imagine doing that sort of thing on a Broadway stage.
Well, it's not on Broadway. It's off Broadway at the New York Theater Workshop. I saw it and it's absolutely terrific. I mean, it could get even better. There's little things they could tweak and do. But I mean, I was very moved by it. It was really well done, beautifully staged, very nice, small, intimate setting. I bet it goes to Broadway. But I'd love, you know, if you have any chance to see it in a small space like this, jump on it because it was really good.
So you're saying it's kind of a big deal that they turned it into a musical?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, then in that case, we should probably move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and determine if they are a big deal or whether anybody should be talking about them at all. Now, our first story, how could we not talk about? In the grand tradition of Super Acts, Madonna will be doing the halftime show at the Super Bowl on February 5th, just like Bruce Springsteen, U2, Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, and so many others. Madonna has a new album scheduled for spring and a single coming out in February.
Shocker!
Want to bet on what song will be included in her mini concert? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. Madonna isn't that far away from smash big albums like Music and Ray of Light. I mean, even two albums ago, she sold 8 million copies worldwide. This will just put her back on top. She's a smart, smart woman.
Alonzo, what do you think?
I venture that it's actually going to be a smart way for her to get more press for WE.
I would say
big deal.
Okay. Old guys, David Letterman and Jay Leno, haven't finished taking shots at each other. For the first time in 17 years, Letterman has beaten Leno in a key demographic during November sweeps. Letterman edged out Leno in the key 18 to 49 demo, scoring a 0.9 versus a 0.8 for Leno. Leno still won the overall viewers, but good news is good news. Craig Ferguson also won during the sweeps month in that demo for the first time ever. Big deal or big whoop, Alonzo?
you know, I suspect that these guys are always going to be hovering around each other with very similar numbers. They're all sort of dividing the same ever-shrinking pie. So I kind of say big whoop. I think every year we're going to see some story like this where they're always going to be neck and neck.
Michael?
Well, they haven't really been neck and neck for a long time. Leno has always been soundly beating Letterman, except for that one year when Letterman debuted on CBS. But NBC has completely collapsed out of prime time. They don't have a single show in the top 40 other than football and the football pregame show. Letterman is on CBS, which has a very strong 10 p.m. lineup. It takes a long time for that to filter through to the local news and then the late night shows. But I think it's finally happening, and he's getting a leg up on Leno.
So it just goes to show you how important those strong lead-ins are.
Absolutely.
The classic film La Dolce Vita was briefly in the public domain in the U.S. until a new copyright law allowed some to, quote-unquote, restore their control over certain intellectual property. Paramount believed it had done so and owned the Fellini classic, but when it started to release a 50th anniversary Blu-ray of the movie, they received a cease and desist order from another company that claimed it had the rights to La Dolce Vita. The smaller company has been embroiled in its own battle with a gay porn film called Michael Lucas's La Dolce Vita. That movie went ahead after court battles and went on to sweep the adult film Oscars. What are we talking about here? Winning Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, and, well, this is kind of dubious, Best Threesome. Now, you want more people to watch the Oscars? Meanwhile, Paramount and this company are still trading legal barbs over who owns Fellini. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal that a movie this prominent can be lost in copyright laws. People don't actually know who owns it. That's how confusing and messed up copyright law is. I think it's fascinating. And the idea that there'd be a whole series, you know, porn films famously just make fun of titles of movies and put their own spin on it. To just take the title of a movie, that's kind of bold. You know, Michael Lucas has Gone with the Wind. Why not? You know, it's just, I don't see how he could possibly think he had the right to do that, but I guess he got away with it.
Well, it's my understanding that you can't copyright a title in the first place. So, I mean, I would think the only thing you could sue over is if he also tried to steal the plot. And not having seen Michael Lucas's La Dolce Vita, I don't really know what the comparison is. I doubt there's a helicopter shot of Jesus being carried under. Anyway, I would say big deal, because this is the sort of thing that's going to come up more and more, certainly, as, you know, we see the Disney movies hit their century mark, and do they go out of copyright? And this is going to be an ongoing battle for the next several decades in a lot of different directions. So I think all of these cases are going to wind up setting precedents that are going to matter down the road.
The New Yorker got all Blogger in this week's issue and beat everyone else to the punch. Or if you prefer, broke its word by publishing David Denby's review of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo a week before the December 13th date they were asked to honor. The movie comes out on December 21st. Critic David Denby saw the film early because the New York Film Critics Circle pushed their annual awards up absurdly early so they could be first out of the gate with their announcement. That meant not even being able to see Stephen Daldry's Extremely Loud and giving an extra day to Sony so they could screen a just-finished Dragon Tattoo. Naturally, the critics were asked to adhere to the common practice of holding their reviews until a certain date. Denby and The New Yorker decided not to. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I thought Denby and The New Yorker were ridiculous. They were asked, everybody agrees to see movies, you know, when it's convenient for them, knowing that they won't release the review until a certain date. If they don't adhere to that, then it becomes a pain in the neck for everybody. And his argument, well, there are a lot of good movies that come out at the end of the year, and we have a double issue, and I didn't like this other movie I saw, the Matt Damon film, We Own a Zoo, or whatever the heck it's called. They were just bizarre. It's like that happens every year. There's nothing to do with anything. If you're asked to, if you're not willing to adhere by an embargo date, then don't go see the movie early.
Alonzo?
Well, you know, as somebody who has to deal with this kind of stuff all the time, I find embargoes more often annoying than they aren't. But, you know, in the case of Dragon Tattoo, I saw it in Los Angeles. And not only were they just telling us it was an embargo, they literally made us all tell them in writing via email, yes, I will honor the embargo for this film. So I did that, and I am honoring it. And I think that, you know, yeah, you're right. His excuses weren't very good ones. It'll be interesting to see how, if in any way, anybody's ever going to get punished for breaking an embargo. The trades do it constantly. Yeah. And generally speaking, once the trades do it, everybody else is like, well, forget it. If they broke the embargo, then so am I. Denby did jump the gun on Variety and the Hollywood Reporter, so it'll be interesting to see if there are punitive measures taken and if they matter, you know, because he reviews one or two movies a week. So if he doesn't get to see Sony movies for a while, it's not like there's going to be big empty spaces in the magazine where his reviews would have gone. He'll just talk about something else.
Now, speaking of movie reviews, Roger Ebert let the world know that his syndicated show At the Movies was on life support, and that was, I guess, sometime in November. Now the plug has officially been pulled. The show is going on hiatus until Ebert and his wife Chaz can sort through the many possibilities and figure out if they can keep the show going without having to dig into their own pockets. That's how they've been funding the movie review show up until now. Big deal or big whoop, Alonzo?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, Ebert is still, you know, really the guy who kind of invented this format, and it would be sad to think that even he can't keep this kind of show alive. You know, as somebody who's been a professional movie critic for you know, more than 20 years now, it's a little depressing to see that, you know, the internet is kind of glutted with people who have no background and no training in this sort of thing, and you know, sort of sharing space with people who've been doing it for a long time, who have a point of view, who have an informed opinion. And so, you know, I certainly hope they're able to get it together. I've talked to some people who worry that even if they're able to line up some sponsorships, that the hiatus will sort of kill the momentum that they've built up. But I think the show is an interesting one. They, you know, I like Christy and Ignati, and I hope they're able to keep it rolling. And I hope that, you know, that because if this show can't make it, then film criticism on TV is effectively dead for a while.
Michael?
I have to say big whoop. I mean, it just doesn't have that strong of a ratings, or they'd be able to get the backing for it. I couldn't believe that Ebert and Chaz were paying for the show out of their pocket. That was crazy to begin with. They never should have started without having somebody willing to fund it, either a foundation or advertisers or somebody like that. I can't believe there isn't TV criticism on TV. I've been pushing for that for years. So I don't understand why there isn't somebody doing that, but who knows?
Napster is dead. Long live Rhapsody. The music sharing website Napster is officially dead. Its latest owner redirects people looking at Napster to head over on over to Rhapsody. Napster co-founder Sean Fanning recently said Spotify was exactly the sort of thing they were trying to create back when record labels foolishly considered any and all digital forms of music to be the enemy. And now Napster is, of course, no more. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It's been dead for a long time.
Alonzo?
Yeah, big whoop. It's pretty much the Friendster of music.
Oh, that's a good analogy, actually. Showbiz Sandbox told you about this trend ages ago. People going into bookstores, finding a new book they want to buy, and then going onto their Kindle to buy it. Now everyone is waking up to this fact, which is the industry has dubbed showrooming. That's an interesting way of calling that. In one recent survey, 24% of people who bought a book online say they first looked at the book in bricks and mortar bookstores. Naturally, bookstores are worried. Big deal or big whoop, Alonzo?
Well, brick-and-mortar bookstores have had enough problems, so I would say probably big whoop in that this is one minor chink in the overall armor of the brick-and-mortar industry. As long as people are actually buying the book somewhere in some format, at least all is not lost for the publishing industry. But as far as brick-and-mortar bookstores, they've got much bigger problems on their hands.
Do you care where people buy Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas?
I am very flexible about anywhere they would like to purchase it, as long as they do so from, you know, as long as they buy it new somewhere.
Okay.
Is it available as an ebook?
It is available on Kindle, yes.
Very exciting. I think it's a big deal because the bookstores are not going to be able to survive if people don't buy books via their, you know, via the store. You may buy it at BarnesandNoble.com, but if you don't buy it in their store, they're not going to be able to keep this four-story coffee house afloat. So I think it's a big problem.
Bryan Singer takes on the Munsters. Movie director Bryan Singer has jumped onto the unlikely TV reboot of The Munsters. That hour-long, somewhat dramatic spin on the broad comedy is being overseen by Brian Fuller of Pushing Daisies. Now Singer, the director of X-Men movies and an executive producer on House, has signed on to direct the pilot and take an executive producer title as well. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. I don't think of Bryan Singer. He's had success with House, of course, but I don't think of him as a big TV force yet. But it'd be interesting to see what he does with the pilot. However, this does mean that Eddie Munster is probably going to be very, very good looking.
Alonzo?
Well, I will say big deal, but with the disclaimer that Brian Fuller is a good friend of mine, and I am a big fan of his TV work. And I think that these are two interesting sensibilities that I think will come up with something interesting together. And if not the Munsters, I think something down the road, you know, we're going to see these guys. I've already seen a Twitter campaign to have the two of them do a new Star Trek series on Showtime. So I think we've not heard the last from the Bryans.
Well, I do like Brian Fuller a lot. I meant specifically the addition of Brian Singer to this package. I love Pushing Daisies, and I like Brian Fuller's sensibilities. It'd be fun to see what he does.
No, I hear you.
Elvis Costello has always had an ornery relationship with his record label, or record labels. But he takes this to new heights with his mocking attack on the price of his new box set, Spinning Songbook. Now, this is his box set. Actually, box set sounds a bit grand for a 3-disc set that contains one CD of actual music, one DVD, and one 10-inch vinyl. Costello agrees. It lists for $340. Yes, $340 US, and no, it doesn't include a bonus collection of his entire catalog. Amazon is selling it at the moment for $263. It does contain a hardcover book, a tour poster, a signed autograph by Costello, and is limited to 1,500 copies nonetheless. Costello suggests instead you buy a Louis Armstrong import called Ambassador of Jazz, which contains 10 CDs for $150, adding, frankly, the music is vastly superior. Big deal or big whoop, Alonzo?
I'm going to say big whoop. I love Elvis Costello, but I don't know that anybody under 40 necessarily cares about his music or his proclamations to the press.
Having been to an Elvis Costello concert as late as a year ago, I can agree with you. I was, you know, in the prime age range in the 40s. Michael?
I think it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. I do think there wouldn't be any problem if they had just released the other versions at the same time. You know, this is the future of public of the music industry, these special limited edition box sets that they get people to pay a lot of money for. If they had released the single CD and maybe a CD and DVD set for like $30 or $40, along with this lavish deluxe version that only fans, you know, would be forced to buy if they really wanted to, then they'd be fine. Nobody would complain. But they're making people wait until next year to get that single CD of the concert. And I think that's what really gets under people's craw.
Pierce Morgan is no Larry King. The ratings are in, and they're not good for CNN's Pierce Morgan. Almost any way you slice it, Morgan is at best tied with the low ratings of the fading Larry King, the very same low ratings that led to King, quote-unquote, retiring in the first place. November sweeps the month of October. Certain demos, or overall viewers, in category after category, Morgan is slightly behind, slightly ahead, or essentially tied with the numbers King was pulling in. November sweeps may not be fair, since King was saying goodbye and pulling out all the stops, last November, that is, you know, a year ago. But in October, Morgan drew an average of 589,000 viewers versus 657,000 for King a year earlier. That's well behind Fox and MSNBC. At least he's beating current TV. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. CNN is, you know, like, fading fast. They have nothing, and this was one of their big gambles, and it has not paid off.
Alonzo?
Yeah, I would say big deal in that the network has a lot of problems, and this was certainly not intended to be one of them.
I'm available.
Now, I don't know how to pronounce the name of this Dutch industry group.
Brine?
I don't know. They're akin to our MPAA or RIAA. They have egg on their face. They solicited music from composer... Oh, geez. Here's
Melchior Reitwiet.
Okay, I'll go with that. For an anti-piracy video, they just promised, would be used only at a local film festival one time. But when the composer bought a Harry Potter DVD, he found out they'd been using the video and his music literally all over the world. He's now seeking more than $1 million US for the use of the song, and Brine finds itself guilty of music piracy for an anti-piracy video. Go figure. Big deal or big whoop, Alonzo?
Big deal only in that it's a new illustration to explain to people what the word ironic actually means.
If only Ethan Hawke had known that back in Reality Bites. I agree. It's a big whoop, but it's very, very funny.
Well, and it also leads us to Inside Baseball. But before we get into Inside Baseball, we'd like to say goodbye to Alonzo because, of course, I know you have to take off. Alonzo, where can we find all of your work? If you were going to become an Alonzo Duralde fan, where would you go?
Well, let's see. There's my website is Alonso Duraldi, AlonsoDuralde.com. There is a Facebook page for my website, for my podcast, Linoleum Knife, and also one for my book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. And this week on TCM, they're premiering a new documentary called A Night at the Movies, Merry Christmas. It will be airing throughout the month of December, and I am featured talking about Christmas movies.
I can't imagine why.
And your book is available at bookstores everywhere.
It is. But probably the best bet for getting it in time for Christmas is Amazon.com.
And we will definitely be placing links to all of your work, including your book, your podcast, and of course your Twitter account. You're a prolific Twitterer. Wait, that made
sense. Oh, well, thank you.
But thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thanks for having me on, guys. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Well, that was nice of Alonso to join us, but he skipped away right before Inside Baseball.
Well, yes, our Inside Baseball topic for the week. Now, Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. And now we're going to explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they will affect you. And this week, this story is very geeky, but in the end will actually affect consumers because it's about Verizon Wireless and their $3.6 billion spectrum deal. And spectrum is the actual airwaves or the frequencies that are being sold off by the FCC to individual entities such as AT&T and, in this case, Comcast and others. Verizon Wireless is coming in and buying some of this spectrum.
Don't they already own some of the spectrum? Because they have the Fios network where they offer cable and telephone and internet to people. Is that strictly done over the wire?
That's strictly done over the wire. That's all wireline, as they call it.
So why are they buying spectrum? And they're buying it from Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and Bright House Networks, which I've never heard of the last one. But they're buying the spectrum of airwaves from these companies. Why are they doing that?
Well, so that they can continue to grow their network. They need to compete with AT&T. They need to compete with Sprint. And they need more spectrum. And that's,
so this is for their cell phones or for their...
Cell phones. This is for cell phones.
Okay. But why are those companies selling it?
That's a good question. I think that they're selling it because, let's face it, if you're a cable company now and you're Time Warner or you're Comcast, you realize in some way, shape, or form, you need to get into the wireless game because it's great that you have this wonderful wired infrastructure, but more and more, the infrastructure is going wireless. So it's kind of like saying you have
selling. Then that would mean they should hold on to it, shouldn't it?
Well, yeah, but they don't have the money to build out a wire. They don't have the money to build out Verizon. That's really what it comes down to. You can either build out Verizon on your own, which will cost way more money. That's going to cost a fortune. Or you can team up with people who already have that infrastructure in place. The problem is you can't buy Verizon because if you did that, then you get into antitrust issues.
So instead of just selling their stuff or instead of trying to build up a wireless network, they're going into a deal with Verizon. Is that the idea?
That's the idea. So Verizon will be... When you go into a Verizon store, now Verizon, for those of you who are outside the country of the United States, is a telephone provider. Yeah, it's a big wireless mobile company. So they're like Orange in the UK and France. So here you have Verizon that when you go into their stores, you can buy cable all of a sudden. You can buy internet access through Time Warner or Comcast or any one of these providers.
So it's just more bundling. Right now, I'm bundling on my home. I have Time Warner Cable. I have the landline telephone and I have internet all bundled together in one package. So this would be a chance to bundle that together if I was a Verizon customer to bundle it with my cell phone and presumably get some sort of savings?
Presumably, yes. You get that one phone bill. So instead of triple play, phone, internet.
Quadruple play.
Yeah, quadruple play. That's exactly right. It's like a, you know, quad play or whatever they're going to call it. But, you know, these groups, Comcast and Time Warner, the cable companies, were arch enemies with Verizon because Verizon was kind of
trying to launch their cable service.
Yeah, I mean, they were kind of interloping is the word I was looking for there into the territory of the cable companies. They had it, you know, Fios, so it was an internet service provider, something that Comcast and Time Warner do. And they were offering a cable, you know, basic cable and digital cable, something that both Comcast and Time Warner, that's their core business. But now they're going to be frenemies, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen any... advantages to the bundling. I suppose it's easier in billing. I only have one bill. But frankly, their offers are so silly. I don't even need a landline, but it's too expensive for me to just take cable and internet. And so therefore, I'm forced to take a triple play and take phone, cable, and internet. Because if I eliminate the phone from that mix, they charge me more money. So I'm like, well, all right. I have a phone sitting here unplugged, never plugged in, never used, sitting there because they make it inconvenient for me to not get just what I want.
And yet somehow this does not break antitrust laws. Go figure.
So do you think this is a good deal for consumers, or is it just too complicated to figure out at this stage?
At this stage, it's too complicated to figure out. You know, if you were to ask Craig Moffat of Sanford Bernstein and Company, and he's a cable analyst, he wrote in a report that this deal was, quote, a complete reordering of the competitive universe as we know it today. End
My
quote.
God. It's as if the Transformers linked up. Well, never mind.
Yeah. I mean, it's let's face it, you know, as these groups become bigger and bigger and bigger, there will be less and less and less consumer choice. And somehow that is being put forth to consumers as better for us.
But yeah, I almost went with Verizon Fios. I looked deeply into that. It turned out that I didn't do that, but I was very close to going with them. I wanted more competition for Time Warner Cable because I don't like how limited my options are. So I'm sorry to see one more competitor go away as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Verizon Fios, this is their fiber optic television service. And it, of course, offers internet
phone
as well.
And internet.
Yeah. You know, it has 4 million subscribers and they're going to continue. Verizon is going to continue to operate it.
Yeah, but they've sort of abandoned it.
They've
stopped building it out. They're not really promoting it as much anymore. They did it to sort of put pressure on the other guys and perhaps get this deal to happen.
Well, perhaps, but I doubt it was this deal that had, you know, that was the reason. I think they really thought it wasn't going to cost them as much as it cost them to build it out, and it was costing them a fortune, and they were losing so much money that they finally decided, wow, building a wireline network, it's really expensive. So Verizon realized doing the cable company's job was expensive. The cable companies realized building a wireless network like Verizon had was going to be too expensive. So why not combine, you know, why not team up? And that's exactly what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that brings us actually, and it's kind of a nice little segue into our listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Again, you can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And we have to thank we'll thank Raul next. But first, we have an email here from Richard P. From New York, New York. And it kind of touches on this whole, I don't know, what would you say, legislative oversight?
Laws proposed before Congress, yeah.
This email touches on that and refers back to what we talked about last week during Big Deal or Big Whoop, which was SOPA, which is an act for copyright infringement, and Protect IP, another act for copyright infringement. Michael, do you want to read it? Do you want me to read it?
I haven't read it yet, so why don't you do that?
Okay. Dear Michael and Sperling, after listening to your explanation of SOPA and the Protect IP Acts on episode 127, I just had to write in and clarify a few things. You mentioned that both of these acts would allow for copyright holders to go through a due process. This is not exactly true. These laws call for the government, to pull down any website whenever a copyright holder claims infringement, not once it is actually proven.
I don't think that's true, is it?
No, actually it is. I went and looked that up.
But the article I read said that they had to go to a judge. In some versions of some of these laws, you would have to go to a judge. That's not just whenever somebody claims. That's go to a judge and make your case.
You go to the attorney general, not a judge. That's the way the laws are written.
Well, there's no laws written. These are all both versions in debate that are changing all the time. But
right.
Anyway.
What's worse is that the definition of infringement is so broad that it could include anything from posting of copyrighted material to a simple link to a third party, which may, somewhere deep inside their website, have user-generated content that references copyrighted work. In addition, both of these laws would obliterate 1998's Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And thank you for writing that out, as opposed to just saying DMCA and making me explain it. Anyway, it would obliterate the DMCA, making it against the law to, quote, avoid confirming a high probability, which is a quote directly from one of those two acts that are in Congress right now. It makes it unlawful to confirm the high probability that material infringes copyright protection. This means sites that contain user-generated content would be held responsible for everything that users post on them, and goes a step further in making it impossible for any search engines, credit card companies, or ad networks to do business with such websites without being held responsible for infringement themselves. This means such sites would have a hard time launching, let alone staying in business. Maybe venture capital mogul Fred Wilson put it best in writing on his blog, quote, venture capitalists will think more than twice about putting $3 million of early stage capital into startups if they know that the vast majority of the funds will go to pay for lawyers to defend the companies instead of to hire engineers to create and build product. Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube were three-person companies not so long ago. And that's a quote from Fred Wilson. I'm not one to promote piracy, or more directly, the theft of intellectual property. However, the proposed laws are way too broad and appear to have been written by entertainment industry lobbyists. Let's not forget this is a technophobic industry which fought the VCR, the DVR, DVDs, and the MP3 player, all of which are technologies they wound up exploiting for billions of dollars. Remember when former MPAA head Jack Valenti said to a congressional hearing investigating the lawfulness of the VCR, and this is a quote from Jack Valenti, quote, I say to you that the VCR is to the American film producer and the American public as the Boston Strangler is to the woman home alone, end quote. It's time for Hollywood to stop treating technology like the boogeyman and start figuring out ways to profit from it. Love the show, Richard P., New York, New York. That was a long email, but I found it fascinating, and it caused me to actually go and look up that quote from Jack Valenti. And I found
That's a famous quote, yeah.
I found it in basically what were a subcommittee on of Congress, and it was a committee that was held on home recording of copyrighted works. And I read this thing, and I can't remember. It was from April 12th, 1982. And that line is actually in there. And Valenti goes on to talk about how it will allow people to skip commercials. He was like way ahead of his time.
Yeah. Well, and they thought it was the devil. I really appreciate his letter. He clarifies a lot of things that we both agree, I think, are bad about the laws as proposed, and they're being worked on. They're vague. They're too broad. These are all the sort of things that hopefully with our comments and people speaking up will get clarified and tightened or refined. While the two bills work their way through both houses of Congress and get through to the Senate. Certainly, you know, we're all for intellectual property protection, but we also like fair use and, you know, people being able to do reasonable things online without having the government slap down on them. But I'm looking online at Wikipedia, and it says, according to Wikipedia, that the Protect IP Act says that it authorizes the U.S. Department of Justice to seek a court order in rem, which is against the thing, against websites dedicated to infringing activities themselves, if through due diligence an individual owner or operator cannot be located. The bill requires the Attorney General to serve notice to the defendant. Once the court issues an order, not the Attorney General, but the court, that is not the same thing, it could then be served on blah, 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 blah. So at least one version of one of the laws does involve going through the court, not just having the government act on its own, just because somebody raises a red flag. But again, I agree with you completely that many parts of this law are way too vague and not good, and they need to be strengthened much better before it goes into law.
Well, and the reality is very often when legislative bodies get involved in this kind of technology, they aren't really clear about the technology themselves. And so they do rely on lobbyists and their own professionals to do it, and it winds up being a hodgepodge. So hopefully you're right, Michael, that they'll fix it before it gets
voted. Well, and Richard's right. I'm sure it was written by lobbyists. I mean, in fact, I'd be surprised if it wasn't.
Good point.
They said, make this the law.
Yeah.
Well, here's another letter from Raul in Oregon.
Now, I don't know if we want to read the whole thing, but and that's because, you know, we read a letter from Raul last week, but more so because he said he felt a little, why don't you go ahead, Michael?
He says, Sperling, thanks for the shout-out, but having my fawning letter read back to me today made me realize I sounded like a 13-year-old writing to a pen pal as part of a middle school assignment, albeit a somewhat eloquent 13-year-old. I assure you it's quite the contrary. I've been associated with entertainment site thetrades.com, that's the-trades.com, almost since its inception in 97, and I've been its owner, publisher, and editor-in-chief for more than a decade. I love entertainment news and hate entertainment fluff. I remember watching Entertainment Tonight as a youngster when it was the only source that told us who got cast in what movie and what new shows were coming next fall. Now it's all about the Kardashians and Lohans. It turns my stomach. I couldn't agree with you more, Raul. Tell Michael I have plenty of love for him too, but you're the guy who keeps showing up on the Twit Network while he remains the masked commentator. He's got a face for radio, eh? I admire his cynicism and skepticism. As a trained historian, I swear I have a degree in everything. I'm all about sources, and I know how easy it is to warp data to serve your means. So I especially love it when you bait Michael with the latest pronouncement from an analyst. Analysts say it's the best leap year at the movies in the past 4 years. Cue Michael rant in 3, 2, 1. I went ahead and gave you guys stellar reviews in iTunes, literally 5 stars. But even I don't dare venture into the Zune marketplace, and I'm a diehard Microsoftie. I say this as I type this email on my shiny new MacBook Air, alas. Well, keep up the good work. All the best, Raul in Oregon. Well, Raul, I think you sounded much more adult that time. An eloquent 30-year-old, perhaps. Who knows? But we really appreciate your watching the show and your comments.
Well, likewise. And, you know, I didn't know whether we should read it because, you know, he mentions the fawning letter from last week. But I thought, well, hey, it kind of mentions Michael. And also it mentions the fact that he's the editor, publisher, and has been working on a site called thetrades.com. So I thought, hey, why not?
Absolutely.
But, you know, you could write to us. Again, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You could call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, you can find that information as well as ways to subscribe to our podcast. You can subscribe in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher or through your RSS reader or your favorite podcast catcher. All of those links, as well
as Santa Claus.
Well, I don't know about the Santa Claus one, but, you know, all those links. And by the way, feel free to review us in any one of those, you know, podcast directories. We really appreciate it. And we'll read your name during the next episode. Those are all on showbizsandbox.com. That's our website. You'll find ways to follow us. We're on Twitter. Showbizsandbox is the username to look up. You can like us on Facebook. Again, showbizsandbox is our username on Facebook. Links to all of the stories we talked about in today's episode, as well as links to Alonzo Duralde's work, can be found on our website too, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael, where can you be found? In New York, but, you know, online, where can you be found?
My website, michaelgiltz.com, has just been spruced up and updated. It looks basically the same, but I've got to update with all the articles from this year, so that's in good shape. And you can also find me on Huffington Post and on Twitter at Michael Giltz.
I'd like to thank Alonzo Duralde for joining us today. Some of my work can be found on Celluloid Junkie. And until next week, play nice.